Hi, Simon Hill here. Enjoy our podcast? If you'd like to help us keep delivering the sort of quality football chat you want, then you can show your support by making a donation. Big or small, however much you can afford, we appreciate all your help, and every cent will be ploughed back into improving production. Thanks in advance from all of us at Shim, Spider, and so much more.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's Craig Moore.
Ericsson's corner kick. Celtic couldn't handle Wood at the set piece. It's a brilliant header. And Cahill goes to Spinsengler. What about that? What about that? Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
For us.
He's yeah! Scored!
You're with Shim, Spider, and so much more. Take it away, fellas.
Yes, hello again. Good to have your company for episode 19 of Shim, Spider, and so much more. How time flies. As you may have noticed, we've moved to a new server this week via Acast. This is one of a number of changes we're hoping to implement over the next few weeks to make the podcast a better technical product and therefore a better listen. We'll have more to come on that next week, I hope. As for this week, we've got Kevin Muscat coming up as our special guest in the final part of the show. And before that, we'll be discussing, among other things, the domestic transfer system and FFA's decision to block Wellington Phoenix's application to join the W League. So let's welcome my two comrades as we head into battle. Zeljko Kalats, aka Spider, who's still waiting for the big kickoff in Greece, and Craig Moore, who's perhaps still being swept up in Scottish celebrations at qualifying for a first major tournament since 1998. How are we, gentlemen?
All right, lads.
Very well.
Spider, you're still waiting for a start date in Greek Super League 2. What on earth is going on?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of things in my career, but I've never seen something like this where we just don't know when we're going to start. So now they're in this mini lockdown till the end of November. There's talk is that it could be in December sometime, but mate, that's to be seen. We really don't know. All we can do is keep training, keep preparing and waiting to get told when we can play.
Goodness me. Maury, Scotland defeating Serbia on penalties to earn a place at the Euros. So big celebrations in your neck of the woods. Interestingly, Lyndon Dykes, of course, a part of it. And his comments this week saying he chose Scotland because playing for Australia was the easy route to the World Cup. It's all a bit unnecessary, isn't it? Or is he just playing to the local audience?
Mate, look, maybe. I think I'd rather probably stick to the fact that... you know, something that we kind of experienced, Simon, in Australia, you know, 32 long year wait for World Cup qualification. Scotland have waited 22 years to be back on that main stage again. And Lyndon Dykes played an important role for a large part of that game. I thought Scotland were very good against Serbia and probably over the course of the full 90 minutes deserved to go through. They conceded late, as we know, and Serbia did have a late crack at them, but Scotland managed to go through on penalties. So, look, fantastic. Good time for me to be back, to be honest with you, Simon, because there's a lot of positivity now about the game and also their group at the Euros. Two of those games will be in Scotland as well. So, fantastic news for Scotland.
Indeed. They could be playing England as well, I think.
Is Wembley, right? Yes, correct. Oh,
that'll be interesting. All right. Looking forward to getting your thoughts on a load of different topics, guys. Let's get into it with Hard Talk.
Hard Talk.
Hard Talk is brought to you by Streamgate, which has been live streaming since 2008, specializing in custom-built stream pages, pay-per-view, and multi-language streaming. They can cater to large online conferences with multiple simultaneous streams and destinations, including all social media channels servicing clients Australia-wide. Go to streamgate.com.au or find them on Instagram. So, guys, one of our major topics this week is the domestic transfer system. FFA says it is working on the development of a DTS reform white paper. Sounds like government, doesn't it? To be launched in early December. I think we all agree we need this domestic transfer system. But how should it look? Should it just be the same as we see in Europe, or do we need to adapt it to an Australian market? Maury.
Look, I would like to see us, for the majority of whatever transfer system is going to come in place, for it to look a lot like what it does throughout the world, Simon. I think that makes a lot of sense. Look, we need to understand that in Australia, still financially, the game is struggling. So all of a sudden, if you're thinking that, you know, A-League clubs are going to buy players for $500,000, $1 million, that's not going to happen tomorrow. So what that's going to look like, but it's more about in terms of the contracts, the protection for the clubs. And I guess if there's going to be any area where we need to be slightly different, Simon, is I think with the younger players, you know. So if a younger player, for example, is not getting the opportunity at a particular club, then you don't want to be in a situation where potentially the pathway or opportunity out with that club can be blocked due to, you know, training compensation, something like this. You know, this is something that potentially can hold back players if they're deemed to not be good enough at one particular club. That's something I think that would need a little bit of work on.
Spider, your view on whether a domestic transfer system will help NPL clubs, because they develop a lot of talent. They don't always get compensated, or at least not in the financial way that perhaps they should be, for developing that talent.
No, 100%. I think we've spoken about this many times on the show. I think it's important that there's money filtered back to the clubs that are developing these players. So we all say the A-League is the top league. We know that they're the clubs with the majority of the money. So if they do want players from the NPL clubs, they've got to pay. Obviously, we're not talking massive, massive figures, but it all adds up. I mean, there's 12 A-League clubs around Australia that can actually filter through NPL clubs and take players that, if they filter money back towards those clubs, they can keep developing young players. So I think the transfers have got to be in accordance to Europe. So I think the deadlines have to be the same with regards to your question about do we want it Australia, just keep it in Australia, or make it more European? I think we have to do it the European. Same deadlines, same everything. Players under contracts. Loans are going to be a major, major point. I think that loans, what kind of figures clubs will be able to get for these loans is another huge thing, because money, as we know, is the biggest problem in Australian football.
And that, and sorry, Spider, that the loan situation, we know that even in Europe and other parts of the world, the old days clubs would pay a loan fee, and then obviously there would maybe be a split in terms of salary. But what we see more and more now, because of the financial situation all over the world, that loan deals sometimes are just now an agreement between clubs where they split the salary. It doesn't necessarily always mean that there's a loan fee involved. And I'm just trying to think again, because finances and how we struggle in Australia, different when you've got these NPL players that are being developed and then they're making the step to the A-League clubs, money must be paid for that. Yeah. Whether or not the loan situation, clubs are going to in Australia pay fees for loan players, or whether there's just going to be a sharing of salary. That would work. It's just not going to be that simple. You know, even in terms of, you know, transfers between Australian clubs, Spides, like, you know yourself, how many clubs are in a position now where they could fork out a decent amount of money for a player? They're not, are they? So I don't know, like, do you then start to look at, you know, a certain amount of money can be paid if an A-League player has played a certain amount of games? I don't know. There's so many different ways you could take this, but it's good that we're going to have a transfer system, loan system in place. It's much needed.
That white paper is going to be fascinating when it is revealed in early December. Keep our eyes on that. Let's move on to a controversial decision already made this week by the FFA to deny Wellington Phoenix the green light to have a team in the W League. Now, Phoenix said to have New Zealand government back into the tune of $500,000, but the FFA has refused to bend the eligibility regulations limiting foreigners to 5 per club. The feeling perhaps, Spider, was that they might use the team as a de facto national side ahead of the 2023 Women's World Cup, which of course we're both co-hosting.
Yeah. And look, I get both sides of the party's stories here. Like, I understand Football Australia for making this decision, because they could just actually put the girls New Zealand team in the W League in preparation for the World Cup. And that's probably wrong for the league. For the W League, it would have been great to have another team in the league, according to the rules of 5 international players. If Wellington really wanted to be a part of it, I think they would accept that.
Yeah, and what is the situation with that, Simon? I mean, I totally agree with the FFA's position. It's, you know, the league is the Australian league, and we certainly, for one team that sits outside of Australia, that actually could be a huge benefit for the Women's World Cup in 2023. We shouldn't be looking to change the eligibility or regulations. I agree with the FFA there, but is there any chance that the Wellington Phoenix would push through under the criteria that the FFA want them to adhere to?
I doubt that, to be honest. And I think, you know, this is obviously where the sticking point is. It appears that, you know, Wellington desperately want to have a W League team. There's nothing wrong with that. That's fantastic. But obviously, they want to use it to develop their players, which is understandable. In the same way that, you know, the Australian league wants to develop for the Matildas and the Socceroos. I'm sort of with you on this, guys. I think you understand where the FFA are coming from. Equally, you understand what Wellington want and are prepared to offer. I think probably the loser in all of this, to be fair, is the W League, because we do need another team. You know, we need a consistent home and away season as well, and a longer season for our girls and women. So anyway, it's not going to happen for the time being, according to the FFA. Talking to the Women's World Cup, the South Australian government this week confirming a significantly increased investment into Hindmarsh, $45 million as opposed to the initial $3 million. New shade over the eastern grandstand, a new pitch. I'm not sure we need that at Hindmarsh. Dressing rooms, corporate media, etc. Is it enough? And crucially, there's going to be no increase in capacity, which is a strange one for me.
What is the capacity?
17.5, I think.
Yeah, it's about 16.5, 17, something like that. Yeah.
Look,
it would have been nice to go up to about 20,000. You would have thought, Maury, 20. But, you know, Hindmarsh at 20,000 is perfect. 45 million is a lot of money. You could actually knock that stadium down and build a new one for that price.
Well, again, I don't know the ins and outs of financially what that would look like. I mean, Simon says that was one of your points, wasn't it, Simon, a few weeks about the investment and making sure that it goes into a football stadium. We speak a lot about boutique kind of stadiums in Australia and how successful they are. I've not got a huge problem in terms of the size, but the investment in an improved facility, I think, is a real positive, and just glad that it's going to something that football is going to benefit from.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, any investment into football, particularly of that size, is to be welcomed. It seems as though we always have to fight so hard, doesn't it, for whatever scraps we can get on the table. And yet this week we see the Victorian government, I know they're not the same as the South Australian government, but handing out $36.5 million off the cuff to develop Witten Oval for a training ground for the Bulldogs AFL team. in Melbourne, and that seems to happen an awful lot, and it doesn't seem to happen very often to our code. Anyway, let's hope that changes with the Women's World Cup on the horizon. Talking of national teams, the Oli Roos played a friendly against Sydney on Thursday. Don't know if you saw any of this game, guys. I actually called it along with Trevor Morgan. Sydney won easily by 3-0 ahead of their Champions League campaign. Any thoughts on where the Oli Roos are at? They looked very rusty first 20 minutes. Better after that, in fairness.
Yeah, I thought the strips were fantastic.
True.
Look, I thought Sydney were a team that you could see it had been together for a while, and the Oli Roos obviously clearly haven't played together for a long time, put together in a short space of time. Not all their players, which is a hard one to gauge as well. There's a lot of good players out of that Oli Roos team that were missing.
Yeah.
But it was a good run for them, and it was a good opportunity for all of them to show Arnie what they've got. They were short. And there's a lot of work to be done still, 100%.
And this is, there's still, Spider, because you touch on also, there's a couple of key players. I think Bahalja, did he play for Sydney, Simon?
He played for Sydney? Yeah, and scored.
And scored. And you've got D'Agostino, obviously, that's been left at Perth. So
Riley McGree, Harry Suter, Daniel Arzani. There's a few still to come back.
Loads. So this may be just a little bit of a discovery group working for Arnie at the moment, to see what's there and to see whether or not, you know, he maybe missed anything or whether somebody was a little bit closer than what he had anticipated. So second game, MacArthur, is that going ahead?
Yeah, that's on Tuesday afternoon, which is recorded, which is played after this recording.
Right.
Yeah, well, what I think it's fantastic that the Oli Roos are getting to play the A-League clubs. I think that's a great initiative. These guys need to play more games together, and the A-League clubs are there. Play against them, play against the NPL clubs. The more games these guys get, the better prepared they'll be.
Hear, hear. All right, let's move on and talk a little bit about the Champions League, which is set to resume this week. Perth taking on Shanghai Shenhua on Wednesday. Shenhua led by Choi Kang-hee, the South Korean who's won the Champions League twice. They didn't have the greatest of seasons in China. They finished seventh, but they got some big weapons. Giovanni Moreno, the Colombian, Stefan Alshaarawy, the Italian, and Kim Shin-wook, who's probably the biggest South Korean I think I've ever seen. He's about 6'6". So how do you rate Perth's chances, Spider, particularly given that Richard Garcia, I'm told, has not got his pro license in time. So he's got to have Chris Ola on the bench with him as well, sort of as a technical director, because you've got to have the right qualifications. They've left out Andy Keogh from the squad, but they do have Castro and Fornaroli. Do you see them having a chance of getting through this section?
Look, I don't really see that they've got a chance of getting through. Shanghai Shenhua, massive club, big underachievers. But Perth will be struggling. They're, you know, new team put together now, short turnaround, going away to play a champ. Look, it's going to be very, very difficult for all the Aussie teams. That's for sure. Difficult.
And by the way, Moreno, he was still there. He's been there for a while. Eh? He was there when Brisbane Roar played.
That's right.
Shenhua, back there. They had Oliver Homi Martins, and also, who was that most expensive player in the world at the time? Tevez. But look, you're right, Spider, that they have underachieved at this level. Any of the Australian teams, unfortunately, are undercooked in terms of preparation, whether we like it or not. Hopefully they go and they perform and they do well. Big ask, though. But most importantly, hopefully everyone that travels is safe and everything is done properly and they return back home safe and healthy.
Well, Sydney posted photos of their trip to Doha with the masks and the visors and everything on social media the other day. They take on the other team in Shanghai, SIPG, on Thursday. Our best wishes, incidentally, to Ryan McGowan, a former guest on our podcast who was diagnosed with COVID. Apparently, still hopefully might be able to play some part in the Champions League campaign once he's done his self-isolation, but we shall see on that one. SIPG, Maury, they lost their Champions League playoff in the domestic league over two legs to Beijing. Oscar is injured. They've won only one of their last seven games in the Chinese Super League. Of course, they have Hulk and Marko Arnautovic, but maybe not in their best moment at the moment.
Yeah, no, and that's a thing. But you look at the players, I mean, you Aaron Moy is obviously your Hulk, and Arnautovic, who we know how well he'd done in England. They have top players, but yeah, they haven't been firing. But sometimes the opportunity to be involved in a different tournament, different case scenario, all of a sudden can bring out different performances. Sometimes that other tournament, like I said, domestic football, and then you have the Asian stuff, or in Europe, you have the European stuff. It's a nice way to break up things and maintain freshness and people challenge within a squad. On paper, they're fantastic, but they've not been hitting their straps in recent times. I'll be looking to change that. Sydney, you know, like all Australian teams, Simon, will be not where they would like to be, I would imagine, but Sydney can be a very difficult team to play against. They're a group that have been together for some time. We know what a great job Steve Corica has done. So, you know, they've got a really good opportunity in this match.
Okay, we'll see how they go. They tend to draw too many games, don't they, in the Champions League. Sydney, they've also got to play Jonbuk and Ange Postecoglou's Yokohama F Marinos, who had a very good win in the J-League, defeating Urawa Red Diamonds to ease the pressure on Ange over the weekend. We'll look at victory next week. They don't play until the 24th of November against Beijing. Quickly on the domestic front before we move overseas, guys. MacArthur FC Spider have signed Benyat Echevarria, 33 years old, 4 caps for Spain, played in the Champions League for Athletic Bilbao. Ante Milicic looks as though he's putting together quite a useful squad.
Putting together a very nice squad, isn't he? Considering the situation in Australia. So, I mean, they're preparing well, and they're recruiting well. I think they're going to have a very good season. MacArthur, I think this is a very good signing. Spanish players are suited very well to Australian football, and especially the way Ante wants to play. I think it's a great signing.
He's got a serious profile, Spides, as well. Over 250 La Liga games. Had played for the Spanish national side, although that was way back in 2012. But at only 33 years of age, he should really go and dominate in Australia. I think it's a fantastic profile. And as you mentioned, Spides, the Spanish players have come and done well in Australia.
We'll see if he becomes another Isaiah, shall we? Other news around the A-League. Bernie Abini not training with the Jets due to stress leave. We covered that on the podcast a week or two back. Mirza Maratovic has signed for Wellington Phoenix. Interesting. I would have thought Brisbane would have wanted to have kept him, a promising youngster. George Timoteu signed for Adelaide United. And the Oli Roo Dylan Ryan has put pen to paper on a deal with Melbourne Victory. All right, let's head overseas, shall we? London calling.
London calling.
Yeah, London calling. Perhaps we should have renamed it this week, Liverpool calling. Spider, I'm going to start with you for our overseas segment. News overnight on Sunday of the death of one of the legendary goalkeepers from the 70s and 80s, Ray Clements of Liverpool and later Tottenham, and of course 61 caps for England, 3 European Cups, 5 league titles, very decorated player, very well respected player, and tragic that he's left us at the age of 72.
Yeah, what a great goalkeeper he was. Sad news and condolences to all the family and supporters out there.
How good a goalkeeper was he, Spider? I remember growing up in England, the debate was always Shilton or Clements. Now, I have to confess, I was a Shilton man, but Clements was a fantastic goalkeeper.
I loved Clements as well. Clements, for me, had a presence and a calmness about him. You know, he reminded me a little bit of David Seaman. You know, like David Seaman was a goalkeeper that you actually didn't take much notice of until you watched him live. Clements was the same. He never done anything extraordinary, but he seemed to do things so easily that you actually forget that's how good he is, because he does it so easy.
Our condolences to the Clements family and to everybody who knew him. No Premier League action, of course, this week, Maury, but some great stories in the Nations League. We've mentioned Scotland, of course, already, first qualification in 22 years, but also the likes of Hungary and Finland, North Macedonia have qualified for the Euros, first qualification for the latter two. Sort of justifies this extended European Championship in many ways, doesn't it? Which I have to admit, I was a bit skeptical of when they first expanded it, but it seems to have sort of galvanized interest in many ways.
Well, it has, because what it's provided is a second opportunity for certain countries, and you know that for me is a wonderful thing. Also, you know, it takes away from, I guess, the meaningless friendlies that we used to see on a regular basis. I think the UEFA Nations has certainly filled that gap. And as we've spoken about quite a number of times this year, how crazy a year it's been, but you know, there's opportunities and surprises and a wind of change in football, Simon. It's great to see some of these teams qualifying for tournaments that normally you wouldn't see.
Indeed.
For me, it was just a bit of Australia in 2005. The excitement of football again, to see, you know, North Macedonia qualify. The streets were buzzing. It was unbelievable. And to see Hungary qualify, Scotland, Maury's been on the drink for 3 days. Still celebrating.
Mate, it's lockdown. Where are you drinking?
What else is he supposed to do?
Simon, a strange one. Just quickly on the Scotland one. It's a very, very strange one, right? Because people in Scotland don't necessarily support Scotland. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. It's a really strange scenario. A lot of politics and the religious kind of undercurrent of things. It's weird. Like, for me, it should be just a great moment for Scottish football and everyone's behind it. But you still get some people that aren't behind their teams qualified for the Euros. They don't support them.
Well, let me tell you, it's exactly the same in England in certain spots as well. It's one of the very complicated things about the United or disunited kingdom is that people are much more attached to their club sides than they are their national teams. Anyway, that's for another day. Maybe we'll discuss that on a future podcast. Talking of England, they went down to Belgium by 2-0. No surprise there. The Belgians beat us every single time. France, the world champions, beat Portugal, the European champions, by the only goal, N'Golo Kante with the winner. And Sergio Ramos missed two penalties for Spain as they could only draw with Switzerland. Moving away from the Nations League, want your views on this, both of you guys. UEFA has written to FIFA this week to request an adjustment to the handball rule again. Alexander Seferin wants referees to be given back the discretion as to whether a player has handled a ball intentionally or not. Goodness me, we do tie ourselves up in knots with all this. And whilst they're about it, if they're going to look at the handball rule, can they look at the offside rule as well? Can we just go back to how it used to be, for goodness sake?
Wouldn't that be great? Hallelujah. Common sense, the handball and the decisions. And every weekend we're debating whether, actually not whether it is or it isn't. It's like, how is that given? How is that a penalty? Another thing, Simon, even the penalties, like any contact now in the box is a penalty, isn't it? Mm. You know, whereas the rules over a period of time you're allowed to make contact in the box, but some of the penalties that I've seen.
You'd have given away about 100 penalties a game, I think.
At least.
Oh, dear.
But the offside one, I mean, what was it? Was it the Bamford one that for me, I think, has set all this rolling, because that was an absolute joke, it was.
Spider, I suppose I should ask Maury this more than Spider, but we saw that Nobby Stiles and Jack Charlton passed away recently through dementia. Very, very serious topic, this. And Gareth Southgate has sort of said something very interesting this week in the UK press, admitting that he's a little bit concerned for his future after, and I quote, heading an awful lot of footballs during my career. Maury, as a centre-back, this was part of your gig, wasn't it? You know, in the air, winning balls in the air. Is this something that concerns you? And do we need a lot more research into this? Because it appears to me that an awful lot of footballers are starting to suffer from this later in life.
And when I seen this come up on the rundown, Simon, I was like, I know how Gareth Southgate feels. I feel exactly the same way. When you start to then consider, my career was, you know, heading the balls, regularly training, warm-ups. It was like, it is a concern. And I know Chris Sutton is also very active in this area around about we need to be doing more, and it needs to happen now, because we don't want to keep hearing of these particular situations popping up, which unfortunately they will, but let's do something about it. It is a concern. And like I said, Gareth Southgate coming out and saying that he was concerned about it. Mate, I am as well.
Spider, anything to add on that? Didn't really affect you as a goalkeeper, I suppose, did it? You didn't head too many balls.
No, we just got kicked in the head. No, but I think it's great that they start doing something about it. You could never be better to be safe than sorry. And for people to start talking about this and putting things in place, I think it's a good thing.
Absolutely. Feel-good story from England this week, Spider. We'll stick with you. AFC Wimbledon. I don't know if you ever played there, but they've returned to Plough Lane after 29 years away. I remember going standing on those crumbling terraces at Plough Lane. It was, of course, a non-league ground. And then they left and sort of went on this nomadic journey. And as a part of that journey is the very tragic tale of the fact that they were basically sold down the river by the FA and moved to Milton Keynes because they had no stadium. But they're finally back. And it's cost them only $55 million. And it's a great little stadium. Why do stadiums cost so much in Australia to build? Explain it to me.
That's what I said. I can't believe it because, you know, you can build really nice boutique stadiums for not much money in Europe, but they're made differently in Europe compared to in Australia. In Australia, everything is constructed in a certain way. So, you know, the cost gets blown out. But these, you would know the lower league grounds much better than I do in England. There's some beautiful lower league grounds and they wouldn't have cost a lot of money. And to see these old clubs go back to where they started, where they made history, is fantastic for me.
That's a great story, Simon. I know that you'd love this one, Eli, because you're massive in terms of the history of football. And I think to be able...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Able to return where people know and where it used to happen all those years ago. I think it's fantastic. I think it's a great story.
Yeah, it sure is. And the fact, of course, that this was a club, AFC Wimbledon, formed out of the ashes of the old Wimbledon FC and constructed with the love and attention of their supporters. And they literally held trials on Wimbledon Common when they first came back into being as a football club and had to work their way up. I think they started in the combined counties league in something like the eighth or ninth tier of English football. And here they are back in the league and they've got their own stadium back at their own ground, 200 yards away from where the old Plough Lane used to be. That is proper football and dedication to your club. I think it's absolutely fantastic. So well done, Wimbledon. Quick final one, guys, just on the Premier League. It'll be back this coming weekend. Joe Gomez has had knee surgery for Liverpool. We know that Virgil van Dijk is out for most of the season. And now Mo Salah has been diagnosed with COVID. Now, Liverpool got rather lucky last year. I don't know whether you call it luck, but they didn't have too many injuries. Could this affect their title defence, do you think? They're top of the shop at the moment.
Well, 100% it's going to affect it, but I don't think they played as many games in such a short turnaround last year either. So they're having the same problems that everyone else is having. The COVID's causing a problem. Mo Salah's gone to play with his national team, obviously travelled, got tested over there, and now he's positive. It's a difficult one, but they've got a great manager and I'm sure he'll work it out how to rotate the squad and get the results that he needs. But it'll be a lot harder for him to win this year, that's for sure.
Spides, is rotating now with those huge misses to the squad, is that going to be enough for Liverpool? I mean, does he go out and sign somebody knowing that he's got over £100 million in defenders that are out, or does he look for a loan situation for somebody that can come in for the 6 months?
Yeah, look, he's been quite strategic in the way he signed players since he's got to Liverpool. He's not signed players that he hasn't needed. Now in January, he needs players. So he might actually go out and buy a couple of players, Maury.
Yeah, but I just think, I mean, because they've got two younger boys that have come and done okay, hasn't it? I think it was Nat Phillips and Rhys Williams who've come in. But no Joe Gomez, no Van Dijk. Fabinho's just coming back, I think, Simon, from injury.
Yeah, he'll be back. And obviously he can play there, although he's not a specialist centre-back.
He's not a specialist centre-back. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they'll do something. It'll just be interesting to see whether they sign somebody or whether he looks to get somebody in on loan.
Okay, we'll see what happens maybe come the January transfer window. Thanks for the moment, guys. Time to move on to our final segment. And we've got another huge guest in Footballers' Lives.
Footballers' Lives.
Now, our guest this week was born in Crawley in England in 1973 of Maltese descent. He began his playing career at Sunshine George Cross in the NSL. And after further stints with Heidelberg in South Melbourne, he went overseas for the first time in 1996, joining Crystal Palace, where he won promotion to the Premier League. The following year, he switched to Wolves, where he stayed for 5 years before joining Rangers on a free transfer in 2002, where he won the Scottish Treble the next season. He was then captain of the Millwall side that reached the FA Cup final in 2004, although he missed the final itself through injury, before returning home in 2005 to begin a near 15-year association with Melbourne Victory as a player and then coach, winning 4 grand finals, 3 premierships and an FFA Cup. He won 46 caps for his country, scoring 10 goals in a 12-year international career. And in 2019, he left Victory. And this year, he was named head coach of St Truiden in the Belgian First Division. And he joins us now from his base in the Flemish province of Limburg. It's a big podcast welcome to Kevin Muscat. How are you, Muskie?
Very well, gentlemen. Yourself?
Very Muskie good.
You're looking sharp.
I have to say, Muskie, we've had the biggest response ever to a guest coming on this podcast. We've had so many questions. No way we'll fit all of them in. Not all of them. All favourable,
I bet, Simon. let's
kick off just by asking you about how life is in Belgium at the moment. So you're on an international break, of course, just at present. But fair to say it's been a tough old start to life in the top flight in Belgium. You're in the bottom three at the moment. How have you found it?
Good, Simon. I mean, coming here in the winter break last season in a very similar position to where we are now and pulling away, if you like, from that relegation zone. And look, it's tough. It's difficult. You know, the initial months, you know, brought back memories of what it was like to be back in or involved in cutthroat football, if you like. And look, I was under no illusions of the difficulty of the challenge and the task, if you like. But look, I wouldn't have it any other way. It's challenging. And the two gentlemen that are with us this morning, right now, Simon, will testify because I speak to them regularly about it. It's been very challenging. But look, I couldn't be happier with the task ahead.
Let's get straight into a question because I think a lot of people will be fascinated to know the differences between coaching in the A-League and in Europe. Ethan Spiegs asks, were you ready? Did you feel ready for that challenge? And also, do you see yourself spending a lengthy period of time overseas?
Look, yeah, hopefully. I mean, the latter question first, hopefully. Look, this season, as I said, it's been difficult and it will continue to be difficult. There's no two ways about it. When you, weigh everything up, it's a tough task. Look, we've managed to make some changes and gradually making those changes. And there's so many things that we're happy with. However, it's a task that week to week, it's the cutthroat nature of the business and the media and everything that goes with it. I certainly felt, going back to the question, that I was prepared for it and ready for it. Albeit you soon realise when you get here that it's the isolation of being a football manager is magnified even further because you're a foreigner in taking effectively someone else's job.
Got to be better, Muskie. That's normal.
Sorry, Oz.
I'm saying, you know, when you're a player, obviously the expectation is you're better than what they have, and it's no different as a coach. Obviously, when you come in as a foreigner, you really need to hit the ground running and be better than what's there, really.
Yeah, and that was the thing. I mean, the one measuring tool that we do have is the playing group. Personally, for us, because you know we come in and you know with different methods and the way we train and the way we have meetings and present and analyze opponents and review ourselves. There were so many differences that they weren't used to, and it's taken some time. You know, initially we got some results immediately, so that belief and buy-in was there to begin with. And you know, it's a long story, but you know, I was brought here with the owners and with the current sports director and CEO to play a certain way and to go about things a certain way. And you know, both, you know, all parties understand that that's just not going to happen in a matter of months. We'll need you know, a few windows, if you like, to be able to make the changes to the point where we'll be happy.
Must Kakachi was obviously the player that you did have a big influence in getting the football club. How has Kakachi settled into the football club and to the league?
Very well, very well. I mean, the one thing, Spider, you probably know a little bit more about Belgian football and, you know, having played in Holland. It's a very, very physical competition. You know, I remember playing in the Championship and I thought that was physical back then. But, you know, it's certainly a real physical comp. And for Libby, he's got all the attributes to go on and have a really good career in the game. And initially to be able to hold your own here like he has in the first, you know, 5-6 weeks to come in and almost immediately start to play. He's got the physical capacity with his body size and his speed and power to be able to compete. And in you know, the months to come, we you know, expect some really good things from Libby, but he started really well.
Muskie, let's go back to your playing days, long, long time ago, when you still had some hair, when you started out at Sunshine George Cross. What would you remember about those days? And I think Ernie Merrick was your coach, wasn't he, in those early days? Is that right?
Ernie gave me my debut, correct. Simon, it was, I mean, my memory, when I was contacted by you guys for this, my memory's terrible, Simon. It was about, we're going to look back over your career. I thought, well, you've got all the answers because my memory's terrible. But yeah, I was a youngster and it was my boyhood club, if you like. I started at Green Gully, another Maltese club in the western suburbs, and then was at George Cross, which... was obviously, you know, a club, a social environment where my father spent a lot of time. So for me to get a game in the first team at such a young age was, as you can imagine, you know, he was you know, very proud and likewise myself, because I didn't really know too much more, you know, because you know, a lot of my childhood, a lot of my time was spent at the club, you know, kicking a ball around or waiting for Dad to finish his beer so we can go home.
Ernie Merrick's been a sort of a constant throughout your career. Certainly he was there at Victory. He was your coach. Yeah. You were his captain. You seem to have a fallout a few years ago. Do you two speak now? Are you on decent terms or not?
I think the final nail in the coffin was the grand final in Newcastle, Simon. Yeah. And there was maybe a few words spoken before then, but certainly none since. And it's the whole handshake, comical handshake, annual event that surrounded the whole situation was childish for one grown man and one very grown man.
still with it with your playing days, take us back to 1996. How did the move to England come about? And not just to any old club, but you went to Crystal Palace.
Yeah, again, Simon, I mean, I had that was directly after the Olympic Games. We were at the Olympics in Atlanta. Yes, I had a couple of, Dave Bassett, I went to train with Sheffield United, you know, a couple of years prior to that, maybe 18 months prior to that. And, you know, things went really well. And whilst I was on trial, he got the sack. Howard Kendall actually come in. So, I mean, you remember him, Howard Kendall come in. And obviously when a new gaffer comes in, it's so the training or trial was called off. And anyway, I come back to Australia and obviously Harry Bassett, he went to Palace and they got beaten to play a final. And we were at the Olympics. You know, at the Olympics, I had a couple of options. I had a couple of clubs in Holland I could have went to or back to England. So I chose to go to England and, you know, the first season couldn't have planned or panned out any better, really.
Yeah, you got promoted and you beat Sheffield United, strangely enough, in the final at Wembley.
The coincidence on because we were great. I mean, whilst I was at Sheffield, I become very friendly with a family who, if you like, took me in and looked after me. And I spent quite a lot of time and become very good friends with Steve. And it was the hardest day ever for him because obviously I got to fulfil a childhood dream of playing at Wembley, the old Wembley. You know, having watched, you know, all those FA Cup finals as a child with my father. And, you know, the hardest thing was we were so pleased after the game, but I got Steve and his family some lounge tickets for after the game. And he says till to this day, it was the hardest 2 hours of his life coming in there and sharing a beer and pretending he was happy because it was obviously disappointment for him that they stayed in the championship.
You then moved on to Wolves, Muskie. You played alongside Steve Corica and Robbie Slater, Carl Robinson, who of course, is now in Australia as well. Wolves in that era also had Robbie Keane and Steve Ball. You had a good side, but you just couldn't get promoted, could you? You missed out twice in the playoffs.
Yeah, it was a huge club, and it's obviously you see its full potential now with the backing that they've got. But it was always, we were always there or thereabouts, and you'll remember it well 1 year as well, Son, because it was ourselves and Man City who were at Christmas, we were top of the league. I think we were a point behind you guys, and we were 10 points, 11 points clear of third place, West Brom. And that was my last year at Wolves before I signed a pre-contract at Rangers. And miraculously, as things happened, it happened to me whilst I was managing, then you sort of fall out of the playing squad. And I didn't really play much in the back half of the season. And it was West Brom that beat us to the automatic promotional place. But it was still a massive regret that we didn't win promotion. And without going into detail, there's, you know, again, accountability, people got to take responsibility. There were some things that went on that cost us promotion.
Muskie, do you think that at that time, because you said you signed a pre-contract with Rangers, did that, I mean, it does happen at football clubs, but did that impact the decision for you not to play in terms of the coach and the club?
It wasn't. I was actually, you know, started the year as skipper of the club, Oz, and, you know, Dave Jones was the gaffer at the time, and slowly, as managers do, and, you know, now more than most, I can understand, you know, they're bringing in their own players, and, you know, a number of things happened in that pre-season in terms of my contract extension, and things were, you know, eventually it just got to the point where, you know, I didn't believe what I was being told. And then when I had signed or when it was touted or I did sign a pre-contract, the sort of the relationship, I suppose, fell away with the manager at the time. And it was disappointing, like I said, because I'd been there 5 years and I was club captain at the start of the season, and to finish the way it did in January to be top of the table or an automatic place by 10 points, I think we got a little bit, I suppose, complacent.
Muskie, they finally got promoted the year that you left. but you did okay because you went to Rangers, as you said, and you won the treble at Ibrox that year that you had in Glasgow, linking up with Maury and playing alongside the likes of Mikel Arteta and Ronald de Boer and Shota Arveladze, as well as Maury, of course.
Yeah, it couldn't have been. I've made so many friends at Wolves, so I was really pleased that they won promotion. But gee, if we didn't win anything at Rangers that year, it wouldn't have been too good. So I'm leaving Wolves and they get promoted. But yeah, in all honesty, it was and not because Moore is here, and yeah, it was one of the best years of my life, not only for the football side of it. My youngest James was born there as well, and we won the treble. And it was just a fantastic team spirit and a fantastic, 15, 16 months that I spent in Glasgow.
Musky, it was a great year, the treble. And, mate, we had a decent crew together, didn't we?
I reckon, Spider, did you not make a trip up to Glasgow when we were up there? I'm pretty, mate, you've come and visited me everywhere I've been.
No, mate, I can't believe I didn't even get a story about Wolverhampton. I had one of the best nights ever in Wolverhampton.
Oh, Simon, we got to go back to this one. So, just quickly, Simon, right? I'll do the quick version. So the big fella has an winter break in Italy, and we play through, as you know, in the UK. So I says, Spider, he says, look, I'm coming over, I'm bringing the family, we're all coming. I think, Spider, I've got a game on the 26th, I've got a game on the 29th, I've got a... And he goes, we'll be right. One of the mornings, just come on, we'll go for a bite to eat. We had a few drinks, as you normally do. We end up in the casino, as you normally do. And we got out of the casino, and we must have spent a few hours longer than we expected in there, Simon, because we got out, and the snow must have been 4 or 5 inches thick on the road. So we end up behind a milk float. Simon, you remember how they deliver the milk in the UK. So I live about 25 minutes away now. So you can imagine we're behind this milk float for 25 minutes. So it took us about a normal 25-minute journey. It took us about 2.5 hours, 3 hours to get home. So I basically had enough time to go in, have a shower, and then go straight to training where the big fella slept all day.
Brilliant.
Great stuff. Good memory, Spider.
Oh, brilliant. Gold.
So you leave Rangers after just one season and you sign for Millwall and you get all the way to the FA Cup final in 2004 alongside a certain Timmy Cahill. And unfortunately, you miss out because you got injured in the semi-final victory itself. Does that remain one of perhaps your biggest regrets? Not that you could do anything about it because you were injured, but is that one of the biggest disappointments of your career?
Yeah, it's probably a better word. So I'm disappointment rather than regret because, it's just these things happen. And and it was actually the semi-final. I was injured at Old Trafford against Sunderland where we beat them 1-0. I played in every round up until that. And as you said, it would have been nice. And, going from Rangers to Millwall was a calculated risk because the gaffer at the time at Rangers, Alec McLeish, Rangers were starting to go through some issues financially, and he was honest enough to say, look, it's going to be, we've got 3 fullbacks and we need to start to shift some players. And we were coming into like a World Cup cycle or year, so I thought, well, I've got a better chance of playing. So I went, and it all turned out well because I was playing well. And as you said, we made the FA Cup final with Dennis Wise as the manager. And I had a great relationship with Wise. And again, made some really good friends over the journey. And during the semi-final, I thought to myself after the injury, I thought, I'm going to go home because I just didn't want to be around the place. And, you could see everyone really getting excited and, going to try the suits on and the traditions around the FA Cup, which are fantastic. But Wisey convinced me to stay because he wanted me to be a part of it. And, I went across with the boys. It wasn't played at Wembley. It was played in Wales because of the referral, obviously the stadium being redone. And in the end, I'm glad that I hung around and we played Man United. I'm glad I hung around. And Wisey actually pushed me out in the last moment to lead the team out because traditionally it's obviously the managers that do it. And in the last moment, he was having a blow up with the FA officials because, they were obviously explaining to him you can't go against tradition and, what the English are like with their traditions. And he said, no problem. But in the end, he just pushed me out. So I'm walking out alongside Sir Alex Ferguson with my crutches. And I could tell he wasn't pleased, Simon, because he didn't bloody wait. He just kept walking. He wasn't. I don't think he was pleased with Wise either.
Musky, international football. You were obviously you were involved and represented your country for what 10, 15 years as long. I mean, we all come through together. We're Spider, and a lot of boys used to love when we used to get called into the national team because normally you get people saying I've got a tight hamstring. Yeah, we were trying to get on the phone to Gary Moretti and try and find out ways that we could get back earlier.
it was always quite fortunate because I mean I was always in a city where you can get quick flights and direct flights and good flights. So we'd preempt and get onto Gaz early to whether it was back to Melbourne or back to Sydney for on the night flights immediately after the game or wherever it was in Europe where we'd make plans and good memories. Oz, really good memories of trips to Venezuela and places like that.
That was the trip.
Argentina.
Musky. And I got to touch on it because, like I said, Tony Vidmar had obviously the heart issue. Unfortunately, he missed the World Cup. You were another player that was involved in three or four campaigns and that roller coaster ride of.
Yeah.
Nearly qualifying, not qualifying, and then eventually Australia qualified for the World Cup, and unfortunately you didn't go to that World Cup.
Yeah, look, it's probably something I've only recently let go of because it was eating at me for like I said, only till recently, Oz, and because when I kept looking at the squads or whenever the conversations like this come up. I'd without being disrespectful whatsoever to anybody, I couldn't understand, if it was purely on football, how, I wasn't in the squad. But now I suppose in the last few years, being on this side of the fence and always thought to myself, I always thought I was owed an explanation. I always thought, the game owed me something or, Australian football owed me something, an explanation. But the reality is I understand now and I'm fully accepting of it. The game doesn't owe you anything. No one owes, I'm not owed an explanation because of my services to Australian football. It was a decision that the coach at the time made. And like I said, it's only in recent times that I've been able to release that and not think about it too much.
Musky, I just want to ask you one more question about your club career, which obviously concerns Melbourne Victory. You moved back, as I say, in 2005. You couldn't have dreamt really of the success and the connection you would have had with that club specifically, because you'd moved around a reasonable amount, same as a lot of players do during their playing career. Mm. But Victory is really where you found your home. And as I say, four grand final wins, two as player, a couple as coach. A couple of losing grand finals as well, but overall, an incredible connection that you had with Victory. How do you reflect upon that time now? It must hold a very special place in your heart, that club.
Oh, without doubt, Simon. And it snowballed because you become so synonymous with one organisation and one team and one club over a quite a long period of time that. It's the opposite for everybody else, because everybody else wants to see you fail, and everyone else wants to, because of my affiliation that I had with one club for such a long period of time, and yes, I'd pushed the envelope, and as much as people don't want to admit it, but the success doesn't help you either win popularity votes because people don't want to see the same people, the same teams, or the same clubs succeed. And the time I spent at Victory, we were, very successful from that perspective. And there were a number of things, a number of groundbreaking things that, go back and, we had a league game and there was 50 odd thousand people at a league game. The house full sign went up a number of times at Olympic Park that forged and forced and paid, I suppose, a greater strength to get a purpose-built stadium across the road at Amy Park. So, selling grand finals out in a matter of hours, having 25,000 plus members in consecutive years, It was, you know, just so many groundbreaking moments that'll stick with me for a long time. And the two grand finals that you mentioned as well, Simon, it didn't slip my radar. Both on penalties, none of them in normal or injury time. Both on penalties, so a little bit of fortune. So, but anyway, we move on.
Let's sort of takes us on to some Twitter questions. We've had so many. This is unbelievable. Seriously, they have flooded in like never before. I'm going to ask you a couple of the controversial ones because we have to touch upon them. Let's start with this one. OS sends this one in. Would love some insight into the aftermath of the Adrian Zara tackle in 2011. Mm. You copped a lot of abuse. There was a lot of media coverage about it at the time. Did you know that was your moment to retire? Because I think you actually, that was your final game in professional football, I think, wasn't it, in 2011?
Yes, there was a Champions League game one or two Champions League, maybe one or two Champions League games, Simon, to be honest. But I can't really recall probably. I mean, funny enough, it was, you know, everything that happened post that, Simon, I can't say that it, you know, it wasn't deserved, not the right word, but I've got to take responsibility and be accountable for my actions. When you have time to reflect and we, as we get older, you know, I sincerely, you know, wish and hope that, you know, incident didn't happen. But unfortunately it did. And it was my error and it was my, misjudgment, if you like. And I had to take responsibility for it. And rightly so, I'm still taking responsibility for it now.
That's a very honest answer, Muskie. Thanks for giving that. Let's move on to another one from A-League Wrap-Up. What was said between you and John Cosmina during that infamous touchline scuffle, if you can say it on a podcast? Were there words exchanged?
Oh, I'm sure there were words exchanged, but I couldn't begin to try and remember, or I'd be lying if I told you I knew what was said. In the end, it was really Avidmar trying to get in between us both, whose hand also snuck up around my neck somehow. because he's a great competitor, and I think first seven league games, we'd won all of them, and that was the eighth one, and we were losing 1-0, and we were at home. And till this day, I've had the conversation with Cosy a number of times. I says to him, well, you were holding the ball underneath your seat, and there was no time, and I was trying to get the ball back, and the only way for me to get the ball back was to push you. Did I know I was going to push you? I admittedly say yes. I knew. Did I know you were going to fall off your seat? Yes. But he will not admit ever, and he hasn't admitted to me still, that he was holding the ball away from me. So I've admitted to my side of the story, but he still says he was trying to give the ball back to me, if you believe that.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Let's finish off with a couple of different ones. This is our question of the week that wins a $100 voucher from Outback Steakhouse. Congratulations to Simon McMahon. And Simon asks a very interesting question, I think. How has the prospect of relegation from a competition changed your coaching approach? Good question.
Great question. Interesting. I mean, and it was a few weeks back as well where we hadn't had a result. We hadn't had a win for quite some time, and we were, got to the point where there was, you know, quite a bit of media attention, and there was quite a bit of noise, and what have you. And then it was one of those where, I can go in and try and get a short term fix here in terms of a result, and a result will come and it will undo, what we've, you know, the bricks were put into place over the last, you know, 7-8 months, if you like. So it was basically a catch-22 situation where I thought to myself, well, if I do that and we get the short-term fix, you know, the belief's going to go out the window. So again, that's the moment where you've really got to be true to yourself and stick to your guns. We changed things, we changed even formation, but the principles of what we were trying to do and how we were trying to get results remained. And it was, you know, and you get that with the threat of relegation, because all of a sudden it's, yeah, you know, the cries come from, you've got to do this and you've got to change that and you've got to do this. And it's the beauty of our game that when you're not in a managerial or coaching position, 98% of the population analyze the result. And 2% of the population, the coaches and maybe some players, analyze the performance. So, you know, I kept analyzing the performance, and I still believe we're on the right track. We've made a lot of progress, and even though the threat of, you know, as you said, not only relegation, but the threat of job, the threat of livelihood, all those things, we've decided that we're going to remain true to what we believe was going to be successful from the outset.
Yeah, that's a big difference, ain't it, from being a big club at Melbourne Victory, manager of them, having everything, to being a smaller club in a league where you can't compete money-wise like the Bruges and the Standard Lieges.
Yeah, it's. I mean, spot on. It's. I mean, because everyone starts to make comparisons. Or, you know, Victory, you had the better players, or you were the club Bruges, if you like. And but ultimately, yes, you know, people are different, but it's still football. Yes, there's many ways to achieve things and to achieve success. And what's important is that we don't lose sight of what the definition of success is at any given time. I believe we've made the grounds, and we've made, you know, albeit like I said, a lot of the people only analyse the results, and rightly so. You know, that's why it's so emotional, our game. Having said that, it's important that you remain resilient and you stick to your beliefs. And I've spoke to Ange, you know, quite a few times throughout this period, and he's been a great sounding board for me in that aspect as well.
Oski, we could talk probably for about the next 3 hours, but we're almost out of time. One more question from Rene Faltzen on Facebook. Being of Maltese heritage, were you ever asked to play for their national team? And if so, did you consider it?
No, never was asked, Simon. I think at an early age, I mean, I was, you know, with Maury in the under-20s and stuff. So I think from an early age, it was, you know, obvious that, you know, I wanted to represent, you know, Australia, our home.
Musky, just the last question. I've got to ask this all the time, all right? You've got to be short and sharp. Best stadium you've ever played at, and the biggest dungeon you've ever played at?
Oh, dungeon's a tough one, Spider. The best stadium would have been Wembley for a number of reasons. I mean, the old Wembley because, you know, watching so many FA Cup finals with my father, you know, growing up as a kid and, you know, getting up at all hours of the morning to watch those games. And early on, it was the only games we could watch was the England game, English leagues, and particularly the FA Cup final. And the MCG for that, you know, qualifier against Uruguay, you know, having been in Melbourne and growing up and knowing what that, you know, bit of land means to everybody in Melbourne, that was special as well. Dungeon Spider.
Oh, mate, you played a few of those.
Oh, there would have been, you know, the easiest one was Chapman Reserve. It was probably our ground that was probably the biggest dungeon, Sunshine George Cross. Did you, Spider, you would have been down there.
I've been there. That is a dungeon. That is a dungeon.
I mean, I politely say that in with the greatest of respect, but I can remember, like, my old man, Simon, and it's, they'd let the grass grow longer than normal, and the lines would be painted in a lot narrower, and the pitch would be shorter, and I'd be thinking, what's going on here? It's because we were playing Adelaide City or South Melbourne. They're going to make it as hard as possible for
brilliant.
Them. But,
brilliant.
Yeah, no, good
idea. Oski, time has beaten us, unfortunately. We really thank you for your time. We could talk for hours, but thanks for sparing half an hour to be with us on the podcast, and all the very best of luck with everything in Belgium. And let's hope you survive relegation and go on to greater things. Cheers, mate.
Good on you, Simon. Thanks. Thanks for your time, boys. Really enjoyed it. Take care.
And that is us for this week. Join us the same time next week for more Shim Spider.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.